This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you've been to Montreal recently and then checked your debit or credit card statements, you might have been pleasantly surprised. The exchange rate favors the U.S. dollar pretty significantly right now. That's great for U.S. tourists heading north, but it's not so great for Canadians heading south or purchasing on the global market, and it's not necessarily so great for Vermont's economy, which relies heavily on tourism, much of it from Canadians. Syrup producers are feeling the pain, too, since the global price is set by our northern neighbor. Today on the program, we're going to talk about what's causing this multi-year drop in the Canadian dollar and how it's affecting both economies. We're joined now from Montreal by Tom Velk, Director of North American Studies at McGill University. Professor Velk, nice to have you on the program.
Hi, nice to be here.
And here in the studio with me is Patrick Walsh, an economics professor at St. Michael's College. Nice to have you back on the show, Professor.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So, Tom Velk, I'd love to start with you. The Canadian dollar has been falling against the American dollar for about 5 years now. Why?
Well, first of all, it's a bad idea that this is happening. Canada and the United States really form a single market, much more of a single market, for example, than Europeans, who see themselves as having a single market. And Europeans long ago realized that that was not a good idea. It created all kinds of tensions and problems and troubles, including, the annual war between France and England and Germany. They went to the euro, a single currency. We should have done that long ago. The reasons are complicated. Up here in Canada, we have unfortunately diverted from the American policy of moving away from quantitative easing, raising interest rates. We also have moved away from our previous practice of being quite prudent and responsible with our spending. We've moved into what I might call the Obama model of foolish expenditure. And we can't afford it any more than, say, the Greeks can afford their foolish expenditure. And that, combined, of course, with falling commodity prices, has pushed our currency lower. Investors don't like it because of our new recklessness. On the trade side, we're not making as much profit out of our energy sales as we used to.
Yeah, and that's a big factor, isn't it, Tom Velk, that the falling price of oil, I mean, for an oil-producing nation like Canada, that would have quite a large effect, I would imagine.
Well, from my point of analysis, I think it is the recklessness that's more important. We have a very close tied relationship with the U.S. with respect to our energy sales. And were it not for if we did move in the direction of a much more closely associated exchange rate, then the central banks can do that, move in the direction of a fixed exchange rate. In other words, we could certainly handle the fall in the price of energy. Because, of course, it in many ways it benefits our own citizenry as much as it does in the U.S. I mean, Canadians are pleased that they don't have to spend so much money filling up their cars as they used to. The great need that Americans have for our key exports, especially 25% of America's energy comes from Canada, would mean that we could keep our prices pretty high, or at least we could extract other favors from the U.S. if we had to worry only about our American trade relations. The trade relations on the Asian side are another matter, but I still say a country's exchange rate, a country is like a big business, and people put money into it or take money out of it in the same way as you do a large firm. It's like the Canadian dollar is like a stock in the company called Canada. That stock goes down when investors around the world believe that we are imprudent. Again, the Greek case comes to mind.
Well, and we certainly are seeing investors in the last quarter of 2015 pulling money out of Canadian investments and sending it elsewhere. Patrick Walsh, do you agree with Tom Velk's assessment of why the Canadian dollar is weak right now?
Well, I mean, clearly there's several different effects going on. You brought up the movement in oil markets, and obviously Canada's a very large exporter of oil and gas. So, just to kind of connect the dots on what's going on there, if you're a oil or gas distributor outside of Canada, whether it's the United States or even Japan or China, and you want to buy some of that Canadian oil, you can't just pay for it in your own currency. You've got to turn in, cash in your own currency, get some Canadian dollars, and then go ahead and buy that. With the sort of global fall in fossil fuel prices and oil prices, you just need fewer, you need to buy fewer of those Canadian dollars to get that exact same barrel of oil. So that, I think, is definitely having a big effect. But, you know, Jane, as you mentioned, this sort of long slide in the value of the Canadian dollar, that's been going on for 5 years. So there's other things going on now. And I look at that trend, I look at that long run trend, and while, you know, I agree with Tom that, you know, sort of an impression of international investors of, you know, maybe being concerned about deficits or concerned about monetary expansion, those new policies, I mean, those have not been going on for 5 years either. So, you know, while in over the past year and a half, 2 years maybe, we can look at both this change in oil price explanation, and we can also look at this change in policy explanation. You know, there's also, you know, this trend has been going on for long enough that there's, you know, those can't be the only things.
So, what do you think they are then?
You know, it could be a lot of different factors. You know, looking at whether it's the competitiveness of industries or investment opportunities. You know, I think, you know, the recent movement, you know, has been a little bit more accelerated. So I think there, you know, we can point to more the commodity situation. But, you know, I agree with Tom that there can be these effects from, you know, the concern of international investors. I think it's kind of hard to say that it's entirely that or mostly that.
We're looking right now sort of at the 30,000 foot view of the Canadian economy, the exchange rate between the Canadian dollar and the U.S. dollar. And I'd love to hear, listeners, from you if you've been noticing the effects of the Canadian exchange rate on the ground. It's about 73 cents on the U.S. dollar today, or if your mind works the other way around, it's about $1.37 American for every Canadian dollar. So tell us if that makes you more likely to travel north, maybe less likely to travel south if you're a Canadian listener, or if you're professionally affected, we would love to hear. I know this has been a bad year for people in the tourism industry in Vermont in general, with the bad weather, but maybe the Canadian dollar is also affecting you. Are you seeing fewer Canadian tourists, and do you think it might be because of the weak Canadian dollar? So we would love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Tom Velk, the Canadian dollar has been falling against the British pound for a few years. It's been a little bit more volatile, but still falling in comparison with the euro. The U.S. dollar is relatively strong against both of those currencies. So can you tease out a little bit, do you think the Canadian dollar is really weak, or is the U.S. dollar gaining strength? I mean, the U.S. dollar is clearly fairly strong right now.
Well, partly it is a matter of the U.S. dollar being strong. A couple of nuances about our previous conversation. You know, energy sales are denominated in U.S. dollars. So if you're a Canadian exporter, you are earning U.S. dollars, oddly enough. And as a matter of fact, one complication in all of this is that the oil and energy exporters, especially the oil exporters in the Canadian West, can earn U.S. dollars even though they're living in the Canadian economy for their exports. The exporters here in the eastern part of Canada, we export a huge amount of energy. It's not recognized so often. We export electricity, of course, right down through Vermont. A lot of it goes there. And those sales are not exclusively or even mainly in U.S. dollars, or at least they're negotiated. So the impact is a little worse, I think, for folks on this side of the continent, on the eastern side of the Canadian landmass. On the topic of the relative strength of our currency, the Canadian currency, you know, we are always planetary with respect to the big sun of the American economy, and that's why at least economists like me advocate a move towards fixed exchange rates or much less flexible exchange rates, less volatile rates. And the central banks around the world, including the Canadian Bank, have moved in the direction, first of all, of being uncomfortably accommodating to big central government borrowing. And that has to do with this imprudence point I mentioned earlier. But they also have the idea that they should allow a certain amount of inflation. 2% is the ideal that they keep shooting for. rather than looking for stability. And the way I calculate things, the stability factor that you get from fixed exchange rates has a much bigger payoff. Nobody likes it, whether you're on the Vermont side or the Quebec side of the border, that these currencies jump around, because you can't make plans if you're a business person, or even if you're talking about where you're going to send your kid to school. So anyhow, back to the U.S. Strength question. I think that has to do with what you can call the flight to quality, or the high ground hypothesis. The world worries a little more than a little bit about a return to slow growth or even a recession. I think that's true right across the G7. You've seen the stock markets bouncing around. And when that happens, everybody runs to secure assets, gold, U.S. dollar. And the U.S. dollar is always favored in that sort of thing vis-a-vis a small currency like the Canadian dollar.
Patrick Walsh?
Agree that there's some of those dynamics going on, and certainly with this question of are there is the U.S. rising or is Canada falling, or which combination, so certainly against many of these other currencies, the U.S. dollar has risen very strongly over the past about 18 months or so, and I agree with Tom that some of that is what they call a flight to quality, that international investors are pretty concerned, in particular right now is not just Europe, there's a lot going on in China I think a lot of investors are either pulling their money out or are not putting their money in China because that's slowing down possible financial problems. So that money is coming over to the United States, which drives up the dollar. In addition to that, Tom was talking before about sort of the monetary policy. So, here in the United States, we have the Federal Reserve, which kind of unusually among a lot of central banks is looking at sort of monetary tightening. So raising interest rates, kind of reducing the growth of the money supply.
But they've only done that once so far, and it looks like the outlook suggests that it won't be doing it again in the very short term.
That's certainly true. That's, even just over the past few days, we've seen a lot from the Fed of they're really sort of rethinking how quickly they want to go on that. But the discussion over the past year or so was, when was this going to happen? It was anticipated. Markets were anticipating that the Fed was going to start raising rates. And even that anticipation can start to drive up the dollar. One kind of interesting point, Tom, you was mentioning this idea of, sort of currency unions or fixed exchange rates, and I don't know if he would favor a monetary union with the United States or maybe just a peg, from the Canadian dollar, where it's pegged to the U.S. dollar at a specific exchange rate that's not allowed to move. Certainly there's points to be made, for those policies. I think on the flip side, sort of a cautionary note is, when you look over at the euro, that's what they've done. They've tied together a large number of actually very diverse economies, both culturally, financially, legally diverse countries, into one currency, and so they have sort of a one size fits all. Which works fine when the economy is growing and happy, but when problems hit, you really start to see the downsides of that rigidity. Now, it might be that the U.S. and Canada are similar enough that we would avoid some of those problems. On the other hand, I'm not sure how most Canadians would feel about having their monetary policy essentially determined in Washington, D.C. Tom's right that the Canadian economy does, sort of follow the U.S. economy, but formally giving over that autonomy of their own monetary policy. He brings up the positives, and there are positives, but there's downsides as well.
Tom, I want to come back to this, but let's get into some of our listeners who are sharing their own experiences as well. We got a note from Mike and Joyce in Wallingford who say, "We found that people in the U.S. get a better grasp of the exchange if they hear the rate in U.S. dollars. Today, it's running right around $1.37 for a dollar Canadian. Some years ago, we had the opportunity to buy a cottage on Prince Edward Island. With the exchange at $1.54, we jumped at the offering, and we've been quite happy that we did. And they say, with the exchange rate being what it is, now's the time to buy up in Canada. And no, we are not realtors." So just a tip there from Mike and Joyce. And let's go to Kareem calling in from Montreal. Hi, Kareem. Go right ahead.
Hi. First and foremost, listen to your show religiously from Canada. I love it. I really feel like what you guys are doing gives me faith in journalism. as for myself, I have a startup. I buy all my equipment from the States. For the last couple of months, it has been hurting me, my team, a lot financially. We had to lay somebody off. And me and my wife usually always drive down to Vermont and Burlington about once a month, where we haven't really been doing that for the last 6 or 7 months, and we canceled our Florida trip. So, I mean, it's hurting us in the sense that all that extra fun that we used to have going down to the States, we can't do it anymore when we do the conversion.
Kareem, thanks for sharing your experiences. I'm sorry to hear that you're not coming to Vermont as frequently and that you had to cancel a warm trip down to southern United States. But thank you for sharing your opinions and your experiences with us. Let's go to Jay in Sudbury. Hi, Jay. What are your thoughts?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I'm going to Montreal this weekend. but what I want to make a statement that my son many years ago went to McGill when the price of tuition was half of the good American colleges. And the exchange rate was 85%. So we made out on the deal. Now is a good time to send your son or daughter to a Canadian college.
Jay, thanks for sharing that. We're getting some great tips from people on how to make a little bit of money out of this situation, at least if you're American. Let's go back to Montreal and talk with Edward. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Yeah, I had a similar experience to a Florida trip cancel man in that we went to New York City this summer, and I got the shock, the credit card shock, because I was frugal during my trip, but the exchange rate really like added about 30% to the price of everything, and so that was a factor in deciding how I would spend my vacation. On the money making side, I'd like to rent an apartment this summer and sublet the rooms through Airbnb, because I've noticed a lot of more tourists, American tourists, in Montreal over the winter, and I'm expecting it to be a boom year this summer for the tourist season.
Edward, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. And Edward trying to make some money off this situation as well. And I am hearing anecdotally that some Canadian resorts and hotels are doing well because Canadians are not leaving the country to spend their money in the United States, but may be spending March vacation this year, for example, in Canada. Certainly that's affecting Vermont businesses as well. I got in touch with Megan Smith, our tourism commissioner in Vermont today, and she said that many resorts in Vermont are having special deals for Canadians to try to entice them down. 20% off, 30% off. And Porter Airlines sent out a note to all of its subscribers saying, you can go to Burlington and get some great deals. In fact, some places like Jay Peak are offering Canadian dollar on par with the U.S. dollar for things like lift tickets. So really trying to entice the Canadians, as we talked about on an earlier program. This is a hard year for Vermont tourism, winter tourism, especially in the ski and snow industries. We're talking today about the Canadian exchange rate against the dollar. We're looking at what it means for people in our real lives, but also some of the economic policies that are at play here. And we're going to talk more about the effects this is having on both the Canadian and the U.S. economy coming up. If you'd like to share your perspective, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Or send us a note posted on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're taking a look at the Canadian dollar. It's dropped about 30 cents on the American dollar over the past several years, and we're examining both the reasons why and the effect this is having on both the U.S. and Canadian economies. The U.S. and Canada are each other's largest trading partners, so the exchange rate can affect both countries pretty significantly. We are talking with Tom Velk, Director of North American Studies at McGill University, and St. Michael's College Economics Professor Patrick Walsh. And if you're seeing the effects, whether you're a maple syrup producer or you work in the tourism industry on either side of the border, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Again, that's 1-800-639-2211. And we're hearing from some of you who have very real-world experiences with this, whether it's just shopping and not making a trip to the U.S. if you're in Canada, or maybe it's affecting your business. We heard earlier from Kareem that it is really affecting his business because he buys all of his parts in the United States. So again, share your thoughts and questions. You can go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. And let's go to John, who's calling in from Richmond. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello, Jane. Just a quick comment. The idea of a fixed exchange rate, how do you do that practically when you've got 10 times the population on the south side of the border? Of course, the U.S. side would want the rate fixed kind of where it is now, whereas obviously the Canadian side would want it at par or better. Also, if you tie the two directly, the Canadians will always be tied to whatever policy is going on in the U.S. For example, what happened during the Great Recession when Canadian banking was stable, there were advantages and opportunities for purchases of companies, real estate, and all that sort of stuff in the U.S. At a discount because of the foolishness on our side of the border. So I'm curious. Sounds like a possible idea, but I don't see a practical application of it.
John, thanks for your call. Tom Velk, this was the idea that you were floating and some questions here about how it might work. What do you think?
Well, in the first place, a fixed exchange rate is obviously better. I mean, otherwise there'd be one rate for the Northeast Kingdom. I have two places in Vermont, by the way, one near Jay, one near Stowe.
You mean places that you own?
Like. Yes, that's right. And believe me, I'm taking quite a squeeze since my earnings are up here in Canada. And I have plenty of experience with the personal side. But anyhow, the point about fixed rates. Fixed rates are obviously the sensible thing. Otherwise, there'd be a different exchange rate from New York to Mississippi to California. If you want a successful integrated economy, you have one currency because the different currencies are just obvious. The kinds of problems that are presented to any kind of businessman, the businessman that called in, his parts are on one side of the border, his sales are on the other side of the border, happens all the time. My life is on one side of the border, and it's on the other side of the border at the same time. And it's just an enormous cost and inconvenience to deal with fluctuating and unstable rates. Point one. Point two is the belief that you sort of surrender, quote-unquote, some kind of policy. It rests on the belief that political policies with respect to things like exchange rates or almost anything else, among other things, I'm a Republican. That's a hard thing to believe that I could be that I could still be alive in a university environment and still be on that side of the political divide. But I am not among those who believe that our political leaders are always doing the wise thing, the sensible thing, rather than the thing that buys them votes and political support. The control of central banking is one of the most, from my point of view, the most notorious places where politicians do the wrong thing, typically the inflationary thing, with
respect
to their citizenry.
Well, Tom, it sounds like you and Bernie Sanders are singing the same tune on that then.
Well, oddly enough, yes, the left these days, right around the world, is quite critical of central banking, and so are folks like me on the Republican side. Central banking has a bad record. The 19th century had very little inflation compared to, say, the 20th century. The 20th century, central European governments, inflation gave us Hitler. The 19th century was not a time of absolute stability by no means, but they had financial panics and so on. But by comparison with the 20th, which is the 20th century is the century of central banking, 19th century is the century of gold, the gold standard. The gold standard has a much better record in terms of stability and growth rates.
Let's go to Colin Reed. He's calling in today from New York. He's a professor of economics and finance at SUNY Plattsburgh. Professor Reed, thank you for calling in today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what's your perspective from upstate New York about how the Canadian dollar is affecting the economy of northern United States and especially upstate New York?
Well, our community in northern New York, Plattsburgh particularly, has probably fared a little bit better than a lot of border communities. Communities like Blaine, Washington actually suffered this earlier and more severely than we have, but we're certainly starting to feel the effects now. I sit on the Clinton County legislature, and we see a drop in sales tax revenue, partly due to, at least anecdotally, fewer Quebecers coming down, but also due to the very low oil prices resulting in low gas prices and low sales tax receipts at our local gas stations.
So is this a big deal, do you think, or just something that both economies are going to ride out and you know, what happens within our economies is more important than this exchange rate?
I think it's certainly a very big deal to Canada and certainly a big deal to these border communities. You know, if you look at a graph, I did a little mini study for our local newspaper, the Plattsburgh Press Republican, a couple of weeks ago that imposed the price of oil on the value of the Canadian dollar. And the correlation is almost perfect going back to the year 2000. 85% of the variation or the drop of the Canadian dollars is precisely tied to the price of oil. So their economy is very much tied to this in a way that our economy just isn't. So the experiences between the two communities are very, very different.
That's Colin Reed, a professor at SUNY Plattsburgh. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, if you would like to weigh in, maybe this is something that you're experiencing in your own business, in your own home finances, maybe it's affecting where you plan to vacation, or you're finding an upside to the weak Canadian dollar, maybe on the other side of the border. We heard from one caller who said, look, I'm going to set up an Airbnb in Montreal because we've got a lot of Americans coming in. So do let us know, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Marsha who says, I hope your discussion includes the impact the Canadian dollar has on the bulk price of maple syrup in Vermont. The price Vermont maple syrup producers are paid for their bulk syrup goes down as the Canadian dollar does. And this is because really the price is set, the global market price is set by Canada. So Patrick Walsh, is that one of the negative effects, at least for Vermonters, of this weak exchange, weak Canadian dollar?
yes, absolutely. And that's, you know, with you know, Vermont being a you know, a maple syrup producer, but obviously the Canadian, specifically the Quebec producers, are much, much larger. So the sort of global price of maple syrup follows the Canadian trend. Yeah, I mean that is going to be a downside. That is going to be something that's hurting Vermont producers. So yeah, and I think, you know, the big story that we're getting from this is that any movement in these exchange rates is going to create winners and losers. And I think it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, if the Canadian dollar was moving in exactly the opposite direction, we would have a symmetric set of winners and losers. You know, the American maple producers would be very happy. The Vermont, you know, tourism, you know, would be happening on the Canadian side. They'd be, the fellow would be able to get his, would be able to get his parts for his business. But at the same time, Canada would have fewer tourists. So I think it's very, symmetric problems show up whether the currency is rising or falling.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Colchester. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'd just like to mention that I actually travel to Canada to get dental work done because the cost of dental work up in Canada is actually cheaper than here in the first place. And then with the exchange rate, it actually nets out that without any insurance, I end up paying the same as my partner does, and she has a copay on her insurance to get a crown, for instance. And actually, I had a root canal, and that was even a bigger difference. And it's just a tremendous boon to me, although there's a long travel, but I like going up to Canada.
John,
that's what I'd like to say.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing what's happening in your life. I appreciate that. Let's go to Louise in Bromont, Quebec. Hi, Louise. You're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, and thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a comment to the fellow who called saying he sent his child to McGill University, I believe it was. I just want to say do not send your kids up here to university because it's already costing me, the Canadian taxpayer, $63,000 to educate someone at university. So university is not free.
You're talking about what you pay in taxes in Canada and in Quebec in particular for that also go to education?
It's very, very high. So I just want people to know that, yes, it costs children less to go to university here, but the taxpayer is the one who carries the burden, and that's my only comment. I just wanted you to know.
Louise, I appreciate that perspective, sharing the thought of a Canadian who looks at Americans coming to school and sees a price tag that she's helping to pay for. Matthew is calling from Montreal. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, good afternoon. So I'll just make a quick comment here. I'm a wedding photographer, and I booked my clients over a year and a half ago that I shot this summer, so I am contractually obligated to produce wedding albums that are, for the most part, printed and shipped up from the U.S. So my business just got a whole lot more expensive this year. It's all coming out of my pocket, and there's nothing I can do. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's all over the place. From I really see the only prices that have come down here is gas, and everything else seems to have gone up.
So for you, Matthew, it doesn't matter that most of your life happens within Canada's borders. It's that you're seeing your business and other expenses are actually going up for you.
Yeah, we're hugely connected to one another. So it's. I remember my dad used to joke, he would say, when you guys would sneeze, we'd catch a cold. So that's what's happening.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspective. I'm sorry to hear that your expenses are going up so much, and good luck with the wedding season to come this year. Tom Velk, winners and losers, from your perspective, who are you seeing that's actually benefiting from the weak Canadian dollar versus the stronger American dollar?
Well, there certainly is plenty of politics here. The new government here in Canada is a big L liberal. It leans to the left, and it serves, and it because it is mainly elected by the folks who live in central Canada, especially in Ontario, and they do not get much in the way of votes or support from the western Canada. And what has happened in terms of inside Canada here, winners would include or Ontario manufacturers who are competitive with, let's say, manufacturers in Germany or in Asia, and they are now able to sell their products into the U.S. market and around the world at a more attractive price, at least at the more attractive U.S. dollar price. They get the same Canadian dollars, but they're basically selling their products cheaper, but they're selling more of them. They're probably happy about that. Industries in the West, especially the energy industries, are not really benefiting. And as I say, a skeptic could see this as a political punishment because the West does not support the existing government. And I think the existing government has had more than a little bit to do with the fall in the Canadian dollar. The energy producers out there could certainly sell their product at top dollar prices. And the falling dollar has caused them to have to be sort of more or less forced to accept lower returns from their energy investments. So if there's two impacts on Canadian industry and investors, the Western industries and investors lose, the central Canadian investors. All who also have international markets are winners.
Tom, when you say that you place a lot of the blame on the current Canadian government, Justin
right.
Trudeau just took over in November, right? So does he really bear much of the blame for the falling dollar?
He does. His coterie, or whatever the right word is, the guy who runs the central bank that we had here until fairly recently, but went over to run the Bank of England. He was a very tough cookie in the old school of central banking, and he not only helped keep the Canadian dollar closely associated with the American dollar, but he ran a tight and highly prudent monetary policy.
And that was Carter, right? I think he left in the summer of 2013.
Yeah, that's right. He went. Exactly. And his replacement, first of all, there was a kind of an open area where nobody really knew who was running things at the Bank of Canada. The current replacement is very much a much more weak central banker in the sense of his monetary policy is much softer, much easier. And that ease in monetary policy started up well before Trudeau took over. It happens to help out Trudeau because it helps Trudeau to finance his expenditure policies.
Patrick Walsh, what do you think about winners and losers in this situation?
I get what Tom's saying about the difference between the manufacturers and in the sort of central and east of Canada versus the oil exporters. At the risk of getting into the business of an American telling Canadians what their monetary policy should be. Although apparently, if Tom wants a monetary union, then that's what would happen pretty much all the time. Is Canadian monetary policy would be set down in D.C. In terms of this expansionary monetary policy, I mean, the thing of it is, Canada had very weak GDP growth, especially in the first half of last year, and even since then, it's been very weak. Unemployment rate has come up. It's now over 7%. Truthfully, I think most economists would be pretty comfortable with an expansionary activist monetary policy in an economy that's facing that kind of slowdown. Now, obviously, you've got two economists on your show, and you've got at least two opinions about what this should be. As you know, not a big surprise. But I would view that monetary expansion a little bit differently in the context of fairly substantial weakness in the Canadian real GDP.
Well, I think weakness in most economies mm-hmm. in the developed world at the moment. It looks like the outlook for most of the G7 countries and for the United States included is pretty weak.
Yeah, and I think Paul Krugman talks about worrying about inflation is sort of like worrying about a fire during Noah's flood. You can make the argument that inflation is right around the corner, but people have been making that argument basically for the past 7 years. I think at this point. Actual declines in prices and stagnation in output globally, to my point of view, is a much bigger problem.
All right. Well, good. We can have this conversation again then next year. Tom Velk is Director of North American Studies at McGill University. Patrick Walsh is an economics professor at St. Michael's College. Thank you so much to both of you. Appreciate both of your opinions.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up, we're going to meet the new rabbi at Ojavi Zedek in Burlington. She has big shoes to fill. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Ojavi Zedek in Burlington, the largest and oldest Jewish congregation in the state, is being led by a new rabbi for the first time in 25 years. The previous senior rabbi, Joshua Chasen, was known, among other things, for being willing to take stands on controversial positions on issues like same-sex and interfaith marriages. He retired at the end of last year. And the new senior rabbi is Amy Small. She was most recently leading a congregation in Summit, New Jersey, and she served as the president of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Association. Rabbi Amy Small, welcome to Vermont Edition, and welcome to Vermont.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
What is so unique about Ojavi Zedek that this congregation appealed to you and drew you away from New Jersey?
My first reaction was, my husband and I love Vermont. It's beautiful, and it's a quality of life that attracted us. This congregation, however, is so much of what I value. It's a congregation that values tradition, values innovation, and has a strong sense of social justice as its mission.
Well, not just its mission, its whole name, right? Ojavi Zedek means lovers of justice, do I hear
exactly.
that right?
Exactly. Very good.
And so that was important to you. Why? Why is that such an important part of your philosophy, both in terms of your work and your life?
I believe that in Judaism, we are not supposed to just pray and take care of ourselves, but to take care of the world. And I think that in a lot of places, people do lip service to that, small projects. And that's not a bad thing, but it's not enough. And this is a community that takes it seriously enough that we are constantly striving. That's what I believe Judaism is intended to do for us and for the world.
I mentioned that Joshua Chasen, the previous senior rabbi, presided over some pretty significant changes at the congregation, and it sounds, from what you're saying, like you're planning to carry on that tradition.
I am sure that I will, but I'm also sure that it won't be exactly the same because we're different people. But yes, indeed, that's important to me.
So when you say not just small projects but large ones, what are your priorities?
Well, I'm going to sort that out with the congregation. I think that the most important thing is that we study our texts, understand our values, and also understand the needs of the community. So, for example, the fact that Ojavi Zedek has ESL classes and welcomes people from other religions and other faiths for our Interfaith Seder, for Interfaith Thanksgiving, is engaged with the interfaith community, means that there's a world of possibilities. So I don't yet have a specific project I'd like to name, but in general, a priority on figuring that out.
You come from the Reconstructionist tradition, and Ojavi Zedek is a conservative congregation. Can you first of all just describe what the differences are?
Let's see, standing on one foot. Reconstructionist Judaism was actually the liberal school of thought within conservative Judaism for a very long time.
Within conservative Judaism.
Rabbi Mordecai Kaplan, who was the founder of Reconstructionism, was a teacher at the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is where conservative rabbis are trained, for 50 years. but his theological experimentation and open-minded thinking and his view that American values should be integrated with our Jewish values came up against some of the traditional values of conservative Judaism at his time. And that was in the middle of the 20th century when those who were the followers of Kaplan started to veer away from the conservative movement. But Reconstructionism has valued tradition along with a creative, adaptive approach to Jewish life that is very much like the conservative movement that I've entered today.
Well, Ochavi Zedek had to get special dispensation to hire you. Do you think that's a concern that, any members of the congregation have about you? I mean, I imagine it's something that you had to answer in the hiring process.
Oh, for sure. We had many, many, many conversations about it, and I am certainly aware that that was a concern, and I understand that concern. So yes, it was important that they felt comfortable and understood that I am in the same place as the community.
What does that mean exactly? I mean, some of the things that I was reading were that you promised, for example, to give services in Hebrew, that that was important to the congregation and not something that necessarily you had been doing, but something that was part of this coming together.
Mm-hmm. So we have a core group of people in the community, a sizable core group of people, who love traditional Jewish worship. We call it davening. And they wanted to be sure that I wasn't going to change that or take that from them. I love traditional davening too, so I said, don't worry, I like doing that too. I also understand that there are people in the community, especially among the younger generation, who want something that is more engaging for their needs that may include new versions of prayer. So both of those things are true.
Do you think these differences when we talk about traditions like the Reconstructionist tradition and the conservative tradition, that there's sort of these two denominations, although they came from within the same one, are becoming less important these days in modern Judaism?
They definitely are. And in fact, what we're finding is in the Jewish community across America, less attachment to denominational affiliation. I've always been a denominational person. I've been part of the Reconstructionist movement in a central way for my entire career. So I'm not saying that we should give it up, but I do recognize that we're going to have to make it work.
You know, in terms of Vermont, Jews are a minority in most places in the United States, but even smaller of a minority here in Vermont. Does that change what it's like to be a rabbi and to be a congregation?
It does. I must say that every place I've been, we are a minority. So this isn't new for me. And I have served communities that had very small Jewish populations previously. So I recognize that that means we have to understand what our identity is. That's very specific to where we are in the culture here in Burlington. So it's not unique unless you're coming from the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
You know, it's also, though, Vermont and New Hampshire, which are grouped together in these assessments, are always the states that, in terms of the Pew Research Center, respondents say they are the least likely to be engaged in organized religion at all, of any kind.
Right.
And the least sort of faithful in terms of a traditional faith or a traditional congregation. And so for you then, working within the community, looking at the culture of the community, but also trying to do some outreach and to be a part of the community, how do you do that?
That's a great question. I think it means that we need to meet people where they are. We need to come up with creative ways to take our show on the road and do some things outside of our building and develop creative approaches to ritual and worship and to affirm that there are many different ways to intersect with a religious community. For some, it's learning. For some, it's social justice. For some, it's just coming to celebrate together and being part of a community. So I would say that all of those things are part of our future planning.
You mentioned that one of the things that you are working on and that the congregation works on is not just having that very traditional method of worship, but also ways of working with younger people to have different kinds or maybe more sort of up to date with the culture. And Vermont, as you know, is a very aging population, an aging state. I imagine that your congregation may also be facing that issue. So how do you then reach out to young people?
That's another great question. We have a Chavura program. Chavura means a fellowship. And we're going out there and finding where people are. All we need are a couple of people who are interested in doing something in small groups, and we create those small groups and help to support them. And we think that that's one of the ways that will help to bring people together with mutual interests.
You need the hubs, and then they can find the spokes.
Exactly. And they need our support, and we're doing that for them.
Amy Small is the new senior rabbi at Congregation Ochavi Zedek in Burlington. Rabbi Amy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
That'll do it for today. With gasoline prices below $2 a gallon in many parts of the country, is this the time to raise the federal gas tax to pay for a $1 billion upgrade to the nation's transportation system? Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, Representative Peter Welch joins us to talk about this issue, the controversy surrounding when to fill the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court, and more. So send your questions or comments for Representative Welch to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Anna St. Marie. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.